Hey, our next speaker will be Anthony Sechrist. You just got an introduction to him, I think.
Thanks for being here this morning. This is the only day that I get to participate in this conference, and so I found myself almost in line for the dance camp that's occurring on the other side of campus this morning, but I think I found the right spot. So what I want to tell you about today, just to get you in the ballpark, is a study that I did a couple of years ago under the direction of Paul Heinzman, who I think is right here. And what I wanted to explore were the obstacles and the opportunities for increased engagement in environmental initiatives among Canadian Christian organizations. So essentially, how might we do more and why aren't we doing more? But I'll talk you through the technicalities of the study and a little bit of the rationale as we go forward. One thing about myself before we launch into that, I work with an organization called Arasha. There are over 20 Arasha national organizations around the world. Here in Canada, we work out of three hubs, two in BC, one in Manitoba, and I work with the one here in Ontario. And our work primarily is in the Grand River watershed and the Bronte Creek, if you've been exploring the local geography, which flows into Lake Ontario. There we go. So why this topic? Why this topic? Why the set of questions that I decided to take up? Well, there's a number of reasons. One of those for me is just a personal interest in nature and matters of the environment. But another is the scale of the ecological crisis. As we work our way into the conversation around environmental sustainability and the environmental crisis, one of the things we find is something that we sometimes call the jurisdictional problem, or the jurisdictional challenge. And that is many of the crises that we're thinking about overflow political boundaries. And so it seems to me particularly interesting that the church, as a global network of communities of faith, is one body, there are others, but one body that is uniquely positioned to engage this set of global crises. Here's the way the editors of a book on the world's religions and climate change put it. I think you have the quotation on the screen in front of you. As a pervasive and powerful force in the lives of the majority of the world's people, religions are, at least in theory, well positioned to mobilize millions of people on this issue. Well positioned to mobilize millions of people on this issue. I think that is significant. Another reason for the sort of exploration that I want to tell you about today is that I find that as we work our way into the literature and as we are attuned to the sorts of conversations that happen in environmental sustainability circles, we inevitably find ourselves using words that in Christian communities have deep theological meaning. So there are many places in which environmental concerns and theological or spiritual concerns overlap. When we're exploring environmental economics, one of the central questions is how do we value things, particularly things that the market doesn't value directly? Well, it seems to me that the Christian theological tradition says quite a bit about how we value things within and beyond the economy. Other words like restraint, humility, care, love are words that are operative in environmental conversations as well as in theological circles. Here's a famous quotation, probably used too much, but it comes from Gus Speth, who, among other things, was the dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And at one point he said, "I used to think that the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that 30 years of good science would address these problems. I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, apathy, and to deal with these, we need a cultural and spiritual transformation." To me, this sounds like a call for Christian communities to do more than they already are. Finally, one of the things that strikes me as someone who has participated in churches and parachurch organizations for quite some time is that there seem to me, at least, to be good theological reasons from both what we might call a progressive or a liberal perspective and from a more conservative perspective for getting involved in creation care or eco-justice or environmental stewardship. But why is it that these reasons don't seem to be carrying the day? Why do they not seem to be producing more results? Well, a word about some of the existing research that's out there, since we're a multidisciplinary group today. I'd begin by simply saying that there is a lot. Religion and the environment is a topic that is fertile, and there are constantly new studies being added. Depending on how you search these topics, you'll find over 100,000 citations on a university database. What's interesting to me, though, is much of this work is, as described by some who do meta-analysis, theological in nature. So a lot of the stuff that shows up in under this umbrella is normative, it's text-focused, it's, we might say, non-empirical. So in arguing largely about the meanings of ancient texts. So given this, I was particularly interested in doing a study that was social scientific in nature. So less theological. But being someone who always reverts to theology, I had to find some good theological reason to excuse this social scientific deviation. And I found it in the work of Sarah Coakley. Sarah Coakley is a theologian who makes the observation that churches take up social space. They take up social space, and their way of living out the call of God takes up social space, and so it makes sense that theological and social scientific research might have interesting ways of overlapping. Again, a couple of comments on this field of literature. There are some themes, some related questions that show up as we explore it. One is the question about the impact of religious commitment on environmental performance. People on both sides of the aisle are keen to try to answer the question, if you're more religious, does that make you perform better environmentally or worse? There's a lot of work being done on the thesis that religions, including Christianity, are becoming greener. And then there are lots of case studies. So following the shift from large-scale theorizing, trying to say Christianity is all this, or the world's religions are all this, to looking at specific case studies. And that's the umbrella that I see my own work here falling under. And specifically, looking at obstacles and opportunities. In the research and conversation about environment and how we might do more, this is a common framework for exploring these questions. What are the barriers? What are the bridges? What are the obstacles? And what are the opportunities? There's one particular paper that had a specific relevance to the study, the sort of study that I wanted to do, and that's the one from 2008 by Randolph Haluza DeLay, and it runs under this title in the Human Ecology Review, Churches Engaging the Environment and Autoethnography of Obstacles and Opportunities. So Haluza DeLay here is drawing on his own experience, reflecting on it critically, and trying to distill a set or a framework of obstacles and a set of opportunities. Because of geography and a few other reasons, this paper had particular relevance to the question that I wanted to explore. So let me give you a quick snapshot of where Haluza DeLay comes down in this 2008 paper. He names four obstacles and three opportunities for increased environmental engagement in Christian circles. First, as we might expect, he describes paradigmatic obstacles. He says, these are those elements of theological belief or worldviews that disable attention to environmental concerns. That's number one. The second category are obstacles of applicability. So maybe our theology doesn't say that we shouldn't pay any attention to this, but it might say that it ranks significantly lower than other concerns. Third, there are critical obstacles. And he describes it this way: these are the obstacles that result from an underanalysis of societal and cultural factors. Those factors that affect the human-earth relationship. So an underanalysis. And fourth, there are the convictional barriers, which we're all, I think, very familiar with in our own experience. Barriers on the level of lifestyle and willingness to act. So those are the things that are inhibiting increased action. Now, here are the pathways, again, from this paper in 2008 that he sees for moving forward. First, there are subcultural opportunities, those social practices of congregations that lead to more effective learning occasions. Second, there are motivational opportunities, those dimensions that potentially increase the effectiveness of environmental awareness because of a faith-based commitment. So maybe we will care more about these things because of our faith and not less. And then thirdly, there are public theological opportunities. Many churches and many church leaders have at least some level of experience engaging public theological or common good questions. Maybe this is something that we can leverage on this issue. That's a bit of the background on my studies specifically. Here's how I narrowed down the research question. It's this: what are the obstacles and opportunities experienced by Canadian Christian denominations and humanitarian agencies relative to their engagement in environmental initiatives? I focused my study on organizations and specifically organizational leaders. And that's for the level of influence that I think organizations have. They're gatekeepers, in a sense, in the Christian community. So that's potentially still a large population. How do you narrow it down? Well, I looked at the denominations that were members of the Canadian Council of Churches and the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. And I selected a sample for theological diversity and diversity in polity. So that is, how do these denominations organize themselves structurally, and how do they make decisions? And I coupled that with representatives of humanitarian agencies. So these were member agencies of the Canadian Food Grains Bank. And again, selected a sample for theological diversity and diversity in church polity. With this sample, I conducted 16 in-depth interviews with representatives of these organizations. And these were semi-structured interviews using the obstacles and opportunities developed by Haluza DeLay as a heuristic. I wanted to see if the obstacles and opportunities that he named still appear to have explanatory power, still appear to be relevant today. So I used a directed content analysis approach as I worked with the data that came from those 16 interviews. So beginning by coding for the categories that Haluza DeLay developed, and then looking for data that didn't fit in developing additional categories. So my findings. Well, one of the things that struck me, even as I was going through the interviews, was the prevalence of environmental initiatives in these denominations and these Christian humanitarian organizations. Most of the leaders that I talked to, I think out of the 16, probably 14, could describe environmental initiatives that their organization was carrying on. Some of these were things like internal energy audits, things like waste reduction. Among denominational leaders, I heard about educational programs, so largely focused internally on their own constituents. There was some level of political advocacy, and of course, support for denomination-backed humanitarian programs. So providing food security, drinking water, afforestation projects. Among humanitarian organizations, I heard about secondhand stores or thrift stores, so contributing to a circular economy, reducing waste. I heard about educational programs. These tended to be focused externally instead of internally. Programs related to food security, disaster response, and agroecology. Now, what about Haluza DeLay's observations and his framework that he developed in 2008? Well, it seemed to me that in general, his framework still has explanatory power, and has explanatory power with respect to a larger, more carefully defined population. I say that with a few caveats. One is that, as you might have occurred to you, the categories that Heleuze and Delay uses are pretty broad. And it would be interesting to me if we thought of a number of different issues using the same framework of obstacles and opportunities. It might be that it relates to any number of issues and not specifically to environmental engagement. But here, a little bit more detail about the obstacles and the opportunities that he mentions. First, paradigmatic obstacles. Theology is still a challenge for some denominations and humanitarian agencies. And my interviewees reported this most specifically in contexts where a pietistic approach was still dominant. So a belief that Christianity is largely personal, spiritual, and internal. Once these organizations began to think about the well-being of people physically, environmental concerns seemed to follow fairly directly. That said, and I think we see a little bit of a shift here from 2008, theology appeared to be just about as much a resource or an opportunity for these Canadian Christian organizations as it was an obstacle. Number two, applicability obstacles. A number of the leaders that I spoke to reported to needing to be very careful about the language that they use to describe their initiatives and programs. Some deliberately avoided using environmental language and cast all of their programs as benefits to all of the potentially relevant programs as being beneficial to humans, meeting a human need. One particular story, a leader talked about the fact that their organization doesn't use the word climate change, but they talk about helping people adapt to a changing climate. And they felt that that subtle inversion of the language let them sidestep some of the challenges related to applicability. Critical obstacles in these interviews, where I saw this showing up the most, was with respect to finances and the financial support that all of these organizations require. And yes, here in Canada, they were particularly sensitive to that when they were engaging communities highly dependent on resource extraction, agribusiness, or the fossil fuel industry. Finally, convictional obstacles. Yes, all of the leaders reported, most at least, a certain amount of lifestyle entrenchment. It's hard to change. I asked a number of them about the word countercultural. Was that something that they leaned on in trying to address environmental concerns? Well, some said no. Our faith community still views themselves as being at the center of culture, making culture, not being counter to culture. Others said, yes, we do think of ourselves as being counter to a dominant culture. Sometimes this meant that that's why they opposed environmental initiatives, because they saw that as a part of the dominant culture. And sometimes it meant that that's why they were in favor of environmental initiatives. A few comments on Heleuze Delay's opportunities. Subcultural opportunities. Is the church a subculture, and does that provide us with some bridges into the future? Shared theological convictions were a key thing that these leaders relied on. If their community as a whole was concerned with the common good, if that was language and a philosophical commitment that worked for them, or justice, or stewardship, or peacemaking, those were things that were particularly useful in moving their communities toward further environmental engagement. In addition, having a common liturgy provided many churches with ways to engage these issues, specifically seasons of Lent, the new season of creation. Motivational opportunities I saw echoed in my interviews. These leaders reported needing to make theological cases and connect people with the biblical narrative. Public theological opportunities, yes, some of them addressed environmental issues through a designated church office to speak to government, to speak about public theological issues. Others talked about how there was even an assumption that church leaders, imagine a bishop, that a part of their mandate was to speak publicly on matters such as this. Finally, a few additional observations. One of the key obstacles to environmental engagement in the population that I looked at that wasn't mentioned by Haluza Dilley in his 2008 paper was that of political polarization. This was a theme that showed up again and again in these interviews. One leader put it this way. He said, our Western board members have been reticent for us to be known as a climate change organization, but they're comfortable with us doing family resilience projects, thinking of the Global South. What I know is really climate adaptation, was essentially what he said after that. A second barrier was a growing preference among constituents, so financial supporters, for projects that had a short turnaround time and could show results quickly. Imagine trying to help a community engage climate change with those sorts of expectations placed on you. It's a challenge. A third, and I think this is a shift from Haluza Dilley's time pre-2008, the reality of shrinking capacity or declining resources. We're talking with leaders who are seeing budgets shrink, sometimes numbers of adherents shrink. And so the idea of doing new work was hard to get excited about or to see as plausible. Here's an interesting way that this was reflected from one denominational leader. She said this, the bulk of our audience, so for a particular creation care program, is 60 plus. And that's kind of strange to me because it's not the demographic of our churches. There are lots of young, thriving families. However, they're too busy. They're too busy. So declining resources or shrinking capacity, sometimes because of competing commitments. Finally, what other opportunities did I see these organizations leaning into? Well, one is an openness to new voices. Many of the leaders I spoke with knew that their congregations or their constituents were much keener to hearing from Indigenous Canadians with respect to engaging the land or an environmental ethic or thinking about the Creator than they would have been in the past. And they also talked about voices from the Global South. Their constituents wanted to hear these stories. In fact, one agency leader, a part of whose role was fundraising, said, I don't even ask for donations, I just tell stories. Stories of need and impact of their organization's work in the Global South. Second, there was a renewed openness to collaboration, perhaps a response to declining resources, or perhaps a response to seeing this modeled by parachurch humanitarian organizations. And finally, there was an expanding concept of mission in some of the organizations that I studied. There were denominations and agencies that were in transition, shifting towards seeing mission as wider than evangelism and church planting. I think this has its roots in the Lausanne movement. Some of the key terms here, things like integral mission, holistic mission, biblical justice. So an opportunity for these organizations to involve creation care in their programmatic portfolio. I think I'll stop there. I have just a few other observations that I could make, but I want to be sure that we allow ourselves time to keep moving on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It started off as not really a question, but I wanted to take the opportunity, Anthony, to publicly thank you and your colleague, Peter Schultens, for hosting one of the stops of the ASA field trip on Friday, on one of the field trips. And it created a lot of very positive intrigue amongst the participants and interests. So I am going to ask a question, a very biased question. If you, like me, see the potential for perhaps a more concerted and even more formal relationship between the ASA and in our case, the CSCA and AROSHA?
Hey, we're an organization that works through partnerships. partnerships with individuals and with other organizations. And so that would be certainly something that we would be open to discussing. Arasha is largely a network of such partnerships. Yeah, so certainly. And I hope after your visit to our site in Freelton that you didn't come away with any ticks. That was the report about some students that visited on Sunday afternoon. It is the reality. Yeah, thanks for your comment.
Other questions?
While you're heading there, I'll just make a couple of notes on some things that I didn't say. One of the other things I observed as being very important is denominations making formal resolutions or decisions, in whatever mechanism that is, particularly for staff who knew that they were wading into potentially controversial programmatic streams. For them to be able to say, this is a decision that we made as a denomination, and that's why we're doing this creation care work, was essential to be able to respond to some constituents who didn't see it as a priority.
Thank you, yes. It does seem to me that one needs to persuade governments at a very high level about improvements that are big, and that small groups of people saving on waste paper won't help very much. And then you need to start off by actually finding out what are the really big issues, such as driving to work, overheating the home in winter, concrete constructions, iron production. You can name lots, I'm sure. But the big ones need to be spelt out and then try to push governments somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't disagree with that at all. But I do think that there is much progress that can be made if the church collectively leaned further into these issues and made it clear what was significant to our people and to our constituents.
Anthony, there was a presentation yesterday by Fred Van Dyke who argued that we shouldn't use the term stewardship and we should use the term ecological reconciliation. And then in the there was a question that someone asked, well, given the, for some groups that are not fully supportive, that using the word stewardship may actually get them somewhere along the line as opposed to changing the language. And under your opportunities, the previous slide, you did talk about language being important and the different groups using language appropriate to their group, which would sort of seem to be out of practical sense then to use, in some cases, stewardship, maybe beneficial or whatever the language is of the group. So just any comments on that?
Yeah, I think that's the reality of the situation is that there are different terms that have different levels of resonance, antagonistic or potentially positive in different communities. In the Mennonite community, for instance, there's been a little bit of back and forth around, is it creation care or is it environmental justice? In the larger Arasha network, there are questions about, should we continue to use the word stewardship? And yes, there are some national Arasha organizations who have changed the language that they use because stewardship still implies this ownership over. We're largely using the language of creation care here in Canada, but some people have observed that in creation care conferences, you mostly get a bunch of white people. But if you use the language of environmental justice, you get a very different group of people who engage, even if the actual content doesn't change a whole lot, but the language changes. So I agree that it's significant. For me, it's largely a matter of pragmatics. We want to be honest and truthful, but don't want to create unnecessary barriers. Yeah, so thanks for helping us think about that, Paul.